book session number 9944, reel 2.
Mr. Garrod, Reel 2, how long was it before you were able to become a ferry pilot as such?
Yes, I think we would say that would start when you got your Class 2 qualification, which was for high-powered single-engine aircraft, including the well-known ones like Hurricane, Spitfires, Defiance, Mustangs, and so on. And I attended that course after about 120, 140 hours flying in ATA. It was preceded by an excellent ground instructional course, because one thing we had to know, which didn't apply to RAF pilots, who were generally confined to two or three types in their flying career, we had to know all about all types of engines, including American engines, all types of support systems on aircraft, hydraulics, electrics, and so on. So we got an excellent ground course from a man called Captain Gribble, who was inherited by ATA from the old British Airways, the old pre-war British Airways, and he did an excellent job and should really be commended in the annals of ATA for what he achieved. And then we did the flying course. You'd like to hear about this. This was, in my case, starting on the Harvard, but I think we've already mentioned earlier, I had an American instructor, Tex Pierce, very good, very relaxed, and realized that although we had to do 10 hours, and I hope I'm not being too building myself up too much as a pilot, that I wasn't going to learn much more from the course after 4 or 5. I was able to master everything, and so he gave me instruction in aerobatics, and that, I think we mentioned, was something I'm always grateful for. And then we haven't been through this already in full detail, no. And then we went on to the Master, a wooden aeroplane, much more lively than the Harvard, a British trainer with a Rolls-Royce engine, very lively, not so forgiving as a Harvard, gave you much more of an idea of what a Hurricane or Spitfire would be like to fly. And then the old Battle, and we mentioned, I think, the incident with the Ferry Battle, a big old bomber adapted as a trainer. And then finally, the great day when you were allowed to go out on the Hurricane. We had, I think, two or three Hurricanes attached to the training units. And that was a wonderful experience, an aeroplane which, when you first flew it, it left you behind. I mean, I was way out 6 or 8 miles clear of the airfield before I'd caught up with where I was, you know, made sure the wheels were properly up and everything arranged for cruising flight after the takeoff. But later on, you would find the Hurricane was slow. It's amazing how your reactions build up. When you'd flown typhoons and tempests, you'd go back to a Hurricane and you'd think, what a slow old barge this is. It shows how you adapt yourself to circumstances. And I think if I can say this, I believe that if ATA was a tribute to anything, it was a tribute to the adaptability of the human animal, because if anybody had told me in 1941, looked ahead and said, this is what you'll be doing 2 or 3 years' time, I don't think I would have believed them, that every day you'd start out, you'd go to your unit and you'd see 5 or 6 aeroplanes laid out in the form of collection chits on the desk. You didn't know what you were going to expect, and you might fly 4 or 5 different aeroplanes in one day. It was a wonderful life from that point of view for those who were interested in aeroplanes. But I've wandered again. That was the training pool, and then you were passed out from that as a Class 2 pilot, and I was sent up to Ratcliffe in Leicester, quite a small airfield, a former private airfield owned by a family, the Everard family, I think, who were involved in coal and beer and one or two other things, but allowed this airfield to be used by, I think it was number 7 ferry pool at Ratcliffe. Quite a big pool, but I didn't stay there very long, because they wanted people for a new pool at Cosford, over by Wolverhampton, and an Air Force maintenance unit. And we lived there in the Air Force mess. Our commander was Jerry Steadall, very nice chap to have as a commander, and we were only about, I think, 10 or 12 people in that pool, one of the small ones. Very cosy, very pleasant. You could make requests to fly so-and-sos because you hadn't flown them for a while, or you'd like to get your hands on one, all that sort of thing. They met you if they could. We were very close to the Bolton Paul airfield at Wolverhampton, had a lot to do with picking up the Defiance there, which was an aeroplane, a superb technical aeroplane that was produced to a poor air ministry requirement, I think, and was only remembered as a failure in the Battle of Britain, but it was really a very fine aeroplane technically. And there we flew quite interesting routes up to Scotland a good deal, all over the place really. A lot of what you did in a ferry pool was in the hands of your operations officer. As you may know, we were controlled as regards our main program by 41 Group Royal Air Force, then based at Andover, and it was to them that all the requests for new equipment went, both Royal Navy and Royal Air Force, because we flew all the Royal Navy aircraft as well, and they then parceled out to the pools the program for flying, this to be moved, that to be moved there, and so on. And I think our own operations officer could go back to them and say, look, we've got a pilot going to Scotland, have you got something which he can bring back down here which you haven't dished out in our program? And if he was enterprising in that way, he was very good, save you coming back in the train and all sorts of things like that. And we had a very good man, Jack Deeth at Cosford, who came from the Stock Exchange, I think, from Lloyd's, and he was very enterprising and a good man to have. And then Cosford, if you want to go on from there, I must have done my twin engine training conversion from Cosford. Sometimes that was done in two parts. What we call class three were the light twins. There were only rarely three aircraft in that group. The Oxford, which was the standard Air Force twin engine trainer, and like all good trainers, was not a particularly easy aeroplane to fly, not to fly well anyway. And the Anson, which was a fine old machine, which was our principal taxi aircraft, and there was a thing called the Domini, an old biplane made by de Havilland's. So most pilots, if your commanding officer thought you could cope with it, went on to what was called Class 4 conversion at the same time, and this was the heavy twins, and the instruction was given on Wellingtons and Blenheims, in my time anyway, at White Waltham. Still ran our own flying school with these aircraft there. I think you only had about 8 or 9 hours on the Wellington, 3 or 4 on the Blenheim. I had old Rambo on the Blenheim, the man who I'd had the incident with in the ferry battle. And then you were passed out to fly all the British twins, not the American ones. You had to go back for a refresher course later on the American twins, not because they were difficult to fly, but all the systems were different. They had all the instrumentation for the engines tended to be on the American style, and the carburetors were particular to American aeroplanes. Much more manual operation to do than on British aircraft, which became highly automated. We had automatic systems for supercharger controls and so on. The Americans didn't. But the American conversion was done on the Hudson, an American aeroplane, of course, and you could then fly all the American twins like the Dakota and the B-25 Mitchell and the Boston and the Ventura. And that, I think I did this again. No, I may not have done my 4-plus conversion, as it was called, the American aircraft twin conversion, until I got to Sherbourne, because Cosford was closed down, must have been about 1943, for men, and was given over to the lady pilots that formed the second all-women's ferry unit. And I was then posted Sherbourne in Elmerton, Yorkshire, where the flying was very interesting. A great deal up to Scotland, up to Lossiemouth. It was a wonderful trip, beautiful scenery, and you could fly whichever way you chose. It wasn't like present-day flying, where you got to lodge your flight plan with some authority. You could choose if you wished to go over to the west coast and fly up through the western highlands up to Lossiemouth, or you could stay up the east coast, or you could go low flying. Shouldn't really, I suppose, have been flying low all the way, but you could when the weather was brilliant. low fly over the hills all the way up to Scotland, which of course was wonderful. I mean, I can't think of anything that I'd more enjoy doing now if I could. And we used to get a lot of aeroplane. The Beaufighter was a very common aeroplane for us to get to fly then. A magnificent machine, plenty of power, and a wonderful view. You sat right in the nose, and you could see the ground almost at your feet, rather like a helicopter. And so for low flying, or for any sort of flying, it was a most enjoyable aeroplane. Particularly as sometimes you would be asked to go up to Lossiemouth and then perhaps way back to a coastal command station down in the West Country, which was about as far as that at that time as you could go, the whole length and breadth of the whole length of the British Isles, perhaps 600 miles or so. And that I certainly used to enjoy.
What were the chief hazards of a ferry pilot?
Well, I think bad weather. If you look at the records, 153, is it? You probably got it somewhere. Lost their lives, bad weather, because we had no radio. We were supposed to fly within contact of the ground, visual contact flying, map reading your way. But you couldn't always do that. It was a belt of weather across the country. I think your own pool commander knew that if he enforced or made you stick to the rules entirely, a lot of flying simply wouldn't get done. For example, Liverpool and the whole belt from Liverpool westwards across England to Leeds was a mass of smoke sometimes during the war. You couldn't see the ground, but you knew that you only had to put up with this for 10 or 15 minutes and you'd be out in the clear the other side. Now, if you stuck to the rules, you'd turn back, you see, and stop somewhere. There'd be belts of low cloud and so on, and again, I think your pool commanders knew you went through it. I should perhaps mention another incident which gave me a very sharp lesson in a hurricane quite early in my conversion days. After my conversion to high-powered single-engine fighters, I took off from somewhere, it might have been Whitney, a repaired hurricane, and was following the railway line, poor visibility, low cloud, the railway line, the Great Western Railway line, it used to be called, that goes towards the direction of Bath or Bristol and disappears into a tunnel, unfortunately. And there I lost my railway line, my guiding line of my route. The visibility might have been only about a mile and a half, and found myself very shortly afterwards in low cloud over high ground. And I made one or two attempts to regain contact with the ground, visual contact, but found myself whistling over trees at very low height indeed, and decided this was no good, and pulled up through it, through the cloud, into the clearer air up above, and then tried to find a hole in the cloud to come down. I think many, many pilots have had this experience. Had no radio, you see. So I couldn't call up and guide me down or tell me where the weather's clear. And being fairly inexperienced at that time, I wasn't too sure of the total weather pattern of the country. You used to get to know this later on. You got weather-wise, and that made things very different. And at one time, I did actually undo my straps with the intention of bailing out, because I made one or two attempts. I could just see a bit of a hole through the cloud and the ground underneath, but when I tried to go down through it, I realized the cloud was right down on the ground. But eventually, by going a long way east, I found a hole, safely got down through it, and landed a very shaken man on an airfield somewhere out in East Anglia. How did I get onto this? Talking about, or you asked how the casualties. I think most of the casualties were weather.
How did you feel about the responsibility that you had for selecting whether or not you should fly?
Well, we were the only people, I think. The Air Force couldn't. What's the word? They couldn't authorise their own flights. We had a flight authorisation card, which the Air Force had to accept. Sometimes you would go to an airfield, collect an aircraft from an Air Force station, and the squadron commander or the station commander would say, I'm not going to let you go. And perhaps they didn't know what your experience was, but you could then flash this card before them and say, you can't stop me. And they had to let you go. Well, undoubtedly there was a learning experience about weather, and towards the end of the war I got to know so much more about weather and what to do if you found yourself in trouble. By that time I'd done an instrument flying course, which ATA encouraged you to do, particularly when you went on the overseas flying that we started in when 44 beyond. And that in itself, you see, enabled you to be much happy about weather. You knew you could keep your aircraft at a constant course and altitude, even flying blind in cloud. And that made you much happier about tackling the weather. And with experience came the awareness of what the weather was doing. You could go into the meteorological office at your station, you could have a look, and you could say, oh yes, there'll be a cold front coming down, this will mean this, that and the other. And your appreciation of weather and your understanding of it became far better, and so you felt much happier about grappling with the weather.
What was your opinion of the ATA meteorological offices?
Oh, very good, and the maps and signals people. All the support we had was excellent, I should say. I have no reason to say anything else. I think the training was fine, every aspect. Yes, and the meteorological office were excellent, and they would put up, you'll probably see pictures in that book, Brief Glory, I think, of a Met office showing the weather situation written up on a board. I don't think the weather people had the means of knowing enough about the weather, even over this country, that they do now. They've got much more scientific aids to help them. But they never really let us down badly. There were times when we had to stop. Sometimes snow would bring us to a halt. You know, the airfields were smothered in snow. You'd skid all over the place. We couldn't fly then. We did have long periods of stand down in snowy conditions. Again, I think they're probably mentioned in Brief Glory. And then you'd get much longer periods of fog, I think, then, than we seem to get now, because of we've curtailed our smoke, our smoke abatement procedures.
What did you do if the weather was bad?
Sorry?
What did you do if the weather was bad and flying
well,
was
called
off?
Well, we would sit around, we'd play chess. I remember up at Sherburn we had a wonderful chap, Ron Pass, who could take on six of you at chess at a time. There'd be cards, there was a stand down, people would go off, and some would go to the pubs, I suppose. But if I went up, and when I was up in Yorkshire, I used to love going walking the moors with good friends of mine, like Johnny Redford, who I'd love to meet again but haven't been able to tie down, who was a wonderful photographer, by the way. So if you ever get to hear of him, get him to produce his pictures, because he was, I think, photography was very difficult in those days. You couldn't get the film, you couldn't get colour film, you'd get black and white. I've taken a few photographs, and I'd love to have taken more, but Johnny Redford used to take lots. And anyway, we used to go on scrub days, as we called it, walking in the hills up in the Yorkshire moors.
How did it affect your morale when you couldn't fly because of the weather several days?
Oh, it was frustrating. I loved to fly. I loved to get in all the flying I could. I knew the job wouldn't last forever. I think we were all good mates. We found things to do. But I must admit that if there were three or four days in a row, as sometimes happened with no flying, yes, you got a bit frustrated, naturally.
Getting back to hazards, were the balloon barrages a hazard at all?
Oh, yes, they were, yes, and I did get it entangled in one, but certainly I found myself in the middle of a balloon barrage. It must have been somewhere near Newcastle. Yes, these were all specially marked on your maps, of course. I could show you all the maps we had, but we marked the areas of the balloon barrages with red hatchering or something. And there were corridors through them. For example, there was a corridor in between Liverpool and Manchester, which we had to locate and fly through accurately to miss the balloon barrage. And in the conditions of smoke, which was all too prevalent there, you had to be very careful that you picked up the right marks before you set off on your course through this corridor. Yes, they certainly were a hazard. I don't think anybody actually hit one, but one or two may have done. Again, may be recorded in some of the ATA archives. I don't think anybody lost their life in a balloon barrage.
Did you ever have to fly priority aircraft?
Yes, there were. Yes, I can remember one incident very well. A Corsair, which was an American naval fighter, was wanted by a carrier, the somewhere up in Scarpa Flow, I should imagine, somewhere up there. I didn't, of course, we didn't land on carriers, but it was wanted at the nearby naval base. And these were your collection chit. I've got one somewhere, but you've probably seen them, I expect. They could be marked P1, which meant that you couldn't hand the aircraft over to anybody else. For example, in the ordinary circumstances, if you found there was a weather block at some place like Harden near Chester going north, you could land the aircraft there and hand it over to that unit to take on. It would save you being stuck there needlessly when they had pilots who could do the job anyway, and you could go back to your own base. But if you had a P1 aircraft, you had to stay with it. And I picked up this Corsair from I forget where, may have been Renfrew, to take up to somewhere in Orkney or Shetland. And it was an occasion when they had what they call the Haar, which is a sea fog, comes in from the North Sea and just covers the eastern coast. And it was largely smothering Orkney and Shetland, but everywhere else in Scotland was absolutely brilliant. And I spent about 4 days trying to get this aeroplane into this airfield in Orkney or Shetland, wherever it was. Brilliant weather all the way up from Glasgow or Renfrew, which was the nearest airfield on the west coast that was clear. I'd ring them up. Yes, it's clear, we think there's a gap, and I'd take off. But of course it took me about an hour to get up there, and by that time they were firing red lights through the fog. They'd heard my engine, but no hope of getting down. But I got to know Scotland very well from that episode. Well, you also used to get aircraft with a G registration at the end of them. I mean, an aircraft might have a registration number like FR261. Then if there was a stroke G, that meant it had secret equipment on board. And if you landed that anywhere except its intended destination, you had to arrange for a guard. Sometimes the early radar equipment would require it to have this G letter after. So you were warned about that as well. A permanent guard had to be posted on the aircraft. He weren't very popular if you landed away at some little airfield. Some Richard Airman had to stand by it with his rifle all night.
Were you allowed to use the equipment on board?
Oh, no. Well, you wouldn't always know what it was. I can remember once or twice asking and being told, you mind your own business. Some of these aircraft you took for 100 Group, which was the support group of Bomber Command, had a lot of stuff on. One aircraft I flew, I believe, had the equipment which was used to fox the German night fighter controllers. There was a seat with a big radio console and two big whip masts up above. And I remember asking them, what's this all about? And they said, you mind your own business. And they put you away in some room until you were picked up, where you wouldn't start looking around too much.
What about last flight aircraft? Did you fly any of those?
You mean before they were break up? I suppose I did. Well, the old ferry battle I mentioned. That yes, they weren't... you'd get aircraft which weren't in very good shape, of course. And I can remember an old Defiant from Aberporth. It simply wouldn't meet the run-up requirements. You know, what they call a magneto drop on. It was enormous. And it was spewing oil and coolant and all sorts of things. And what had happened, of course, the unit was disbanding. And there was a maintenance party left to try and bring up their old aircraft into a flyable state. And I can remember running up this thing 4 or 5 times, and I had to say to the old Sergeant Fitter, you know, it really isn't good. And he doctored it up a little more, and please take it, sir, then we can go away. And in the end I did take it, and I flew an old Boston, which was in the same sort of condition. But I think that was condemned on arrival at Sherburn. The oil pressure was falling all the time. It was leaking oil. It was a very difficult situation. You knew you were taking an unserviceable aircraft. It didn't happen very often, though. Quite rare.
Could you refuse to take it?
Oh, yeah. Yes, if it didn't, I mean, you could snag. I mean, spreading. A Merlin engine might have had, for example, 120 RPM mag drop on one magneto. If it didn't have it, the fitter knew the aircraft shouldn't have been passed as serviceable. And you could tell him, sorry, not taking it. You've got a 200 mag drop. And he had to fiddle with the plugs and so on to get them right. And yes, but you know, if you were trying to be helpful, you might say, well, the mag drops, it's a bit rough, but not well go. You wouldn't do it in bad weather, perhaps, but if everything else was good, you might say, all right, well, let this pass.
How confident were you in your ground and flight engineers?
Well, the ground engineers, yes, as far as I know, never let me down, although, well, I could quote two instances. That Beaufort, for example, I believe that engine failure was a result of some ham-fisted maintenance on the engine, they told me later. Then I had a rather sad little incident with a Defiant up in Scotland, Drem or somewhere like that, where I took the aircraft, showed no problems on run-up. But on takeoff, oil started to come into the cockpit in large quantities, and it was found on landing. I was covered in oil from head to foot, engine oil. Oil all over the cockpit. I was very lucky to get it down. I had to guess the airspeed. I couldn't see anything. I was wearing spectacles, remember, and they were smothered in oil. I had to whip them off. And a poor little WAF fitter had left the oil cap off the oil tank. Now, it was under a flap. You might say the pilots had checked it. It wasn't actually a requirement for us to check such things, but she must have just filled it up with oil, closed the flap, the fairing flap, over the oil filler, and left the cap off. And she was put on a charge, and I heard all about this later, and they made her come and apologise to me. It was all a rotten business, and I'm sorry about that. But otherwise, you know, you had very little trouble. When I look back on it, as I said before, remarkable when you think, what did I do, 2,500, 3,000 hours, that must represent several thousand flights, and the incidents were not really very many.
What about the handling notes? What did you think of them?
Very good, very good. You probably know, Paul Watson was our chief technical officer. You've probably seen the little book. Yes, told you all you wanted to know. I was very interested technically, having been with Hawkers. I used to keep in close touch with Watson and Henderson, who used to do a lot of the flight testing, and I went with them on one or two of the occasions when they were doing the tests, the Bristol Buckingham, I remember, right at the end of the war. And I also, if I noticed little things, I used to make contributions. I used to say, are you aware that some Defiant I flew had auxiliary outboard tanks, not mentioned in our notes? And they were always very interested, and I think that side of it was very well done.
Did you always carry your notes with you?
Always. You had to, because you never knew what might happen the other end. You see, even though you had a program, you knew you were going to take this or something up to Rossymouth and a Spitfire back, you might find that your Spitfire was unserviceable, and they say, oh no, you've got to take a Barracuda. So, although Spitfires, naturally, you hardly had to look at your notes because you flew so many. I mean, I must have flown 300 or 400 Spitfires of all types, and those you didn't have to bother with your notes. But you'd be foolish, I think, if you didn't check, because you might have thought the fuel system is like this, and in fact it wasn't so, and you might have mishandled your fuel cocks, which was a very hazardous thing to do if you've got an engine failure on takeoff through mishandling fuel cocks or something, just because you hadn't bothered to read it up and you assumed it was so-and-so, and in fact it was not.
What was your routine? I mean, how many hours would you fly?
Well, I could look up the old logbook here and tell you, try and give you a quick answer. I was said about, was it 40 a month? What was I knocking up here? Yeah, between 30 and 40 hours a month. I think you've got 3 weeks leave. Sometimes you might do a lot more. But that's the sort of figure I seem to have from a quick look at my logbook. And it might be 20, 25 types a month. Yes, particularly if you included variations. I mean, some Spitfires, they were produced, I think, in some 20 or 30 marks of Spitfire, and some of the later marks are quite different from the earlier ones, so it was almost a different aeroplane, although it had the same name.
Was tiredness ever a problem?
No, I don't remember it. No, I love flying. If you felt tired, it was a very pleasant sort of tiredness. I think if you'd had a heavy aeroplane to fly in gale conditions, you've got an awful lot of buffeting, something, but fighting the thing the whole time, I think you were a bit weary at the end of that sometimes. And how some of the slight little girls we used to have coped with that, I don't know. I should think they must have been very weary. because aeroplanes weren't, they didn't have power control, some of them were a bit heavy, and we used to fly in gales, you know, because heavy aeroplanes could cope with takeoff and landing in gales. You got a bit of a buffeting then. I don't remember really being tired. Loved it too much, I think.